Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. My name is Ian Smith. I'm the Companies Editor at the IC. Joining me in the pod today, we have Megan Boxall. How are you doing, Megan?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. You've been writing the 7 days column for us this week.
Big week.
Big week. So you're our generalist expert, contradiction in terms, perhaps. Also in the pod, we have Alex Newman, our commodities writer. How are you doing, Alex?
Good, thanks, Ian. Well, I'm well.
Okay, good stuff. Someone who isn't well is Harriet Russell, who we have over in quarantine in the control room. How are you doing? How are you doing, Harriet?
Yes, good. I'll try and keep the coughing to a minimum.
We are going to turn your mic down during your coughing fits for the good of the listeners. Okay, let's crack straight on with 7 days. Megan, so quite a few big stories this week. Why don't we start off with something that happened kind of at the beginning of the week, which was the BBA warning around the UK's decision to leave the European Union. So what have they said?
Yeah, so the BBA has...
Which is the British Bankers Association.
Yes, it is. They have come out with this warning. So earlier in the week, they had their meeting. And what came out, the headlines that sort of came out of the meeting were the fact that they had been in touch with a lot of the big banks, and the big banks were saying that they were preparing to move their headquarters out of the UK because of the fact that we are leaving the EU and potentially leaving the single market.
And this is something we've talked about on the podcast before, right? At the moment, everyone within the EU have passporting rights in terms of selling financial services and other services within the bloc. Mm-hmm. But they're worried that they'll lose them subject to whatever deal is agreed between the EU and the UK.
Yeah, but what was interesting was what the MD of the BBA said earlier this week was that this was going to be pretty awful for both the UK and for Europe, because if any of the big banks were to move to France or Germany, they'd still have the free passporting and they'd have these banks headquartered here. But there would also be problems in moving those banks there, which could end up being bad for those countries in general. So he was generally just warning, and a lot of...
Is this just lobbying? You know, obviously it's so costly for banks to move that the idea that they would move anyway, regardless of the decision, seems like, you know, a lot of cost for not a particularly good reason.
Yeah.
But that maybe is being a little bit too naive.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of the analysis around what was said earlier in the week was that the BBA were sort of using scare tactics to try and put everyone off, not just the banks, but also the governments and everyone off that the idea that banks should be moving. And people are talking about it, so it might have worked.
No specific names involved. There weren't banks which attached to these.
The FT has reported a Russian bank that might be planning to move some of its operations out of the UK. But a lot of these were kind of off the record conversations. But, you know, you would expect the BBA to know, but at the same time, they are a lobbying group. Mm. I suppose one thing, a story relevant to that within 7 days was the negotiations over the EU's trade deal with Canada. So what's been happening there?
Yeah, so that I think is sort of put people's backs up a little bit, because there's now a bit of concern as to how difficult it is to actually finalise a trade deal with the EU.
And this comes down to some people called Walloons.
Yes.
Explain to us, who are the Walloons?
So the Walloons are the people who live in the south of Belgium. They are the French-speaking part of the country.
Belgium. It's a very socialist.
Socialist part of the country. They have said that they didn't agree to the terms of the trade deal with Canada. They were worried about what it would mean for small businesses. They said the trade deal was great for big business, but not for some small local businesses. So they said, no, we're not having this deal.
And Belgium, which meant that Belgium itself obviously couldn't
sign. Belgium as a whole, said that they put politics before trade.
Yeah, and then we had the Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, saying he wouldn't attend the summit unless all of the EU member states have to agree to the deal. So what this demonstrates, and we should just say, just as we came into the podcast, that the Belgian Prime Minister has tweeted that they should be able to kind of sign up to the deal now. So it might all go through, but it does demonstrate the difficulty of getting every EU member state to sign off on a trade pact.
Yeah, exactly. And the strength that a small number of people can have in changing the outcome for such a wider population.
Democracy in action, isn't it?
It really is. So, like you say, it seems to all be going through now, and the summit's actually being held today, and Belgium seems to have agreed.
Another story that's been getting a lot of attention this week is surrounding the banks. Obviously, we're having the quarterly earnings figures, but people are focusing on the provisions that banks are having to set aside, again, in regards to PPI and past mis-selling. So, what have we had here?
Yes, we had Lloyds yesterday, and they booked another 1 billion in provisions on their P&L account, which saw pre-tax profits dented quite largely. And
So that was an extra £1 billion. Yeah, but why was that?
On top of the £16 billion. So yeah, that's they're saying it's because of the extended deadline. So the deadline for those making claims, PPI claims, is now extended to June 2018.
And the bank said, we think this is the last bit of money that has been set aside.
I think I've said that before, though, haven't
I? I think, yeah, if you believe that one. And we've also just now had, after we went to press, Barclays
today. Yeah, I suppose that is the extended deadline. More people making those PPI claims, more money needed to...
So it's now 2019, the deadline. And there is also, there has been promised previously, a widespread publicity campaign ahead of the deadline, because obviously the government doesn't want to be seen to be stopping people that have a right to redress from getting it. So there will be some kind of awareness campaign in advance of the deadline. So I suppose at the moment, this is still guesswork in terms of the numbers about how much they're actually going to have to set aside.
Yeah.
Okay. But you know, that problem is probably not going away. All right. Well, if we have a look at the news section, and the story we have here is British American Tobacco, which has offered to pay a lot of money to secure the remainder of the state, the remainder of the business of Reynolds American that it doesn't currently own. So what's a little bit of the background here?
What's quite interesting about that question is we don't know what the background is. It really took the market by surprise, I think, last Friday. And they came out, they're going to pay a 20% premium to Reynolds shareholders. It's $56.50 a share, which at the last take was around £46. They did do a big sort of deal which involved Imperial Brands as well a couple of years ago, and that was tricky enough. It was sort of all this brand swapping that went on. But this is sort of the next step, and we suspect the deal might come up against some sort of competition issue.
So that was Reynolds' takeover of Lorillard. And so as part of that, some of the brands had to be sold off, which Imperial Brands picked up.
Yep.
I actually wrote my Taking Stock on this week, the complicated history of the tobacco giants. But there will be some issues around this deal. There have already been some concerns raised. What are they?
Yeah, so particularly the credit agencies are already sort of weighing in on this. Aside from the political angle, they really think that the level of debt that BATS would have to raise in order to help fund this deal would be problematic. And so they've kind of put their ratings for these stocks on the watch list for now, which didn't go down well. It sent the shares down actually about 2% on the day, and then further down this week when that news came out too.
And I suppose in terms of what is good about this deal, and just a little bit on the history of it, is that BAT has this big stake in Reynolds American because it folded one of its businesses in the past into Reynolds American in exchange for this stake in the business. And Reynolds American has, you know, Pall Mall, Newport, Camel, these kind of well-known brands in the US.
Yeah.
So it would be obviously earnings accretive in terms of those getting more profits out of the company for the wider group. But also, Reynolds is quite strong in emerging markets, right, and has other areas of operations that BAT could benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the growth story for Big Tobacco has really been two-sided in that its emerging markets are really sort of the fastest growing markets for them in terms of new smokers, in terms of traditional tobacco. But then obviously in the more developed markets in sort of Western Europe and the US, it's obviously vaping is the new trend. So they've kind of got that as well. And Reynolds actually has, you know, feet in both of those camps. So in terms of cementing their foothold in each of those sort of growth areas, it would be a great deal for BAT. I can totally understand from the board's perspective why they see this as an attractive deal. But yeah, the market has concerns.
And we've had a couple of deals this week where credit agencies have raised concerns about the amount of debt needed to fund it, aside from regulatory issues. The other one being AT&T's takeover of Time Warner.
Yeah, and actually that's already been weighed in on politically as well. Both Clinton and the Trump camps have come in and sort of raised issues about that in terms of the foundation of a monopoly, effectively, and what that would do for market competition out there.
And it was interesting with the BAT thing, when that came out, British American's shares actually fell.
Yeah.
And Imperial Brands shares actually rose on the day of that announcement. So kind of giving you an idea of the instant market reaction.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing about the tobacco stocks, I mean, we've only got two listed in London, Imperial and BATS. And the big thing for them is they're such defensive plays in terms of being income stocks. And over time, what's really fueled investors into those stocks are the consistent returns. So if BATS is going to be diverting an awful lot of money into sort of funding this deal and then integrating it, you've got to start asking questions questions. Maybe it's too early to ask those questions, seeing as Reynolds hasn't even sort of come back to the table yet. But in terms of how they would consistently sort of keep that dividend up, particularly at the yield, which was traditionally around 5%, you know, those are valid questions.
Yeah, I think Reynolds itself is very cash generative, but then if they are going to have to increase the offer price, you've got the question of how much debt the company is going to have to take on. So yeah, that would be an interesting one over the medium term if it does happen. Okay, well, elsewhere in the news section, Alex, I'll bring you in here because you've written a really interesting analysis piece, a comparison really of two of the mega miners, Anglo American and Glencore, two businesses that have had a rough ride with low commodity prices and have put in place restructuring plans and have had kind of different levels of success. But your piece also looks at how the market has kind of graded them on the progress that they've made. So yeah, what did you find here?
So, I mean, the most recent news is Glencore has sold its Australian rail division. That was an announced last Friday. That's the fifth disposal it's done this year, or stake sale, if you include parts of its agricultural business, which were offloaded to pension funds at various stages. That is the background to these sales is about a year ago, Anglo American and Glencore suffering terribly by the downturn in commodity prices and slowdown fears around China. We're looking so heavily indebted that investors and markets were questioning their potential solvency. They needed dramatic restructuring and turnaround strategies. Both Anglo and Glencore decided that sales of their assets were the key way to bring down their debt. Of course,
they also cut their dividends.
They cut the dividends first, and then you know the bulk of the debt reduction plans were going to come from asset sales. Of course, the difficulty of selling in a depressed commodity market assets, which people think aren't that earnings enhancing, was really what crystallised the fall towards the beginning of this year of Glencore and Anglo's share prices, because people thought they're just not going to be able to offload these assets. Since then, they've gone on an absolutely remarkable run. So these are two of the, really, in the whole of London market, two of the best performers this year. And surprisingly, given Glencore's slightly more aggressive disposal pipeline, they actually haven't done quite as well as Anglo American. That's probably because Anglo is exposed to commodities, particularly coal and iron ore, to a greater degree than Glencore, which have both done very, very well. There's the effect of a delayed US rate rise, which is is good for commodity prices, and it has been good for commodity prices over the summer. But I mean, it's really, really remarkable when you look at the valuations now of Anglo American and Glencore, given where they were just a year ago. And
so you would say, and you argue in your piece, that the major factor are those commodity price rises.
Yeah.
But also, the disposals, the fact that they are getting away some of these assets.
Yeah.
What look like reasonable prices are having an impact?
I mean, Glencore's had a greater scope to sell assets at reasonable prices because they're so enormously diversified. They own a rail division, which is slightly odd for a commodities group. They have huge agricultural assets as well, which they've been able to sell at decent prices.
And that's, I suppose, because pension funds want uncorrelated returns. So actually, there's been quite a lot of appetite for agriculture assets, given that they are very uncorrelated with the other assets that pension funds tend to hold. So that's quite an example of finding quite a smart buyer,
yeah,
for the asset.
Yeah. Conversely, I mean, Anglo, they sold their NMB division earlier this year. They've not done much else. There was some talk about selling some of their coal and copper assets. Those sales haven't materialised. What's quite interesting now is some analysts are saying Mark Cutifani, the chief executive of Anglo's decision to scale down to just platinum, diamonds and copper, potentially looks overdone because they've got, they've got some assets which now are profitable, whereas a year ago they were just, they're hemorrhaging losses. And questioning whether this divestment strategy now is the right thing to do. I mean, this is the same analyst. A year ago, we were saying sell everything. So it's interesting to see. But I mean, our argument would be it's still very, very tough, Anglo, because potentially the rise in coal this year, for example, has been good news for them. But whether that's sustainable is a big question. Big questions over China. Huge difficulties in exiting any of their South African businesses as well. So I think the jury's still out. But if you bought shares in Anglo or Glencore pretty much any time this year, then Well done.
Well, we've been waiting for the contrarian bet on commodities to pay off, and this year it definitely has.
Yeah.
If you made that decision, at least as far as these companies are concerned. Okay, well, thanks a lot for that. Megan, I'm going to bring you in because, as we can't get away from if we turn on the TV, the US presidential election is drawing to a close. And you've written an interesting piece about how pharmaceutical companies are braced for the impact that either one of the presidential candidates could have on their abilities to sell drugs in the US, which is obviously one of their most important markets. So, yeah, what have you found? What are the risks here for companies?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because actually, surprisingly, both Clinton and Trump are sort of arguing the same point here, which I think they don't do very often. But they both agree that healthcare in the US needs a real shake-up. And to be honest, it really does seem like it needs to. Buying drugs for US people is so expensive. It's so much more expensive than it is anywhere else in the world.
Because why the market, is that?
Yeah, it's because the market is very fragmented. So in the UK, the government is solely responsible for negotiating the price of drugs, and that applies across the country. So wherever you are buying drugs that the government has negotiated the price for, and it's the same everywhere. And that's the same in the EU as well. But in America, there's lots of different organisations who are all responsible for haggling with the pharmaceutical companies. But that means that the pharmaceutical companies have a bit more power because they are talking to so many different people, and they can, in America, therefore, sell their drugs more expensive.
And just to interrupt, they have had some quite high profile examples of drugs where they've been massively increased in markets by people kind of profiteering off the drugs. And this is something that Hillary Clinton addressed in what you've called an infamous tweet back in September last year.
Yeah, it seems like an issue that's kind of been brewing for a while. And then there's been these companies who have not really behaved all that well. It started with Turing Pharmaceuticals, who the company managed to inflate the price of a medicine that had been discovered in the 60s and bought the drug. So they hadn't done any of the research themselves, but inflated the price by about 50 times and then tried to call it a bargain. And it was all just not great behaviour.
But there's some people that argue that, you know, this is just the market for drugs. And if you want the creation of new drugs, you have to have a vigorous private sector where people can make a lot of money.
Yeah, there's a valid point if that company is making drugs. Right. Turing Pharmaceuticals is not, neither is Valiant, neither is Mylan. They're buying other people's drugs. They're buying other people's expensive drugs and making them even more expensive, which is definitely a bit of a problem when a lot of these drugs have people with illnesses that could kill them. So I can see why Clinton did get very angry about that particular incident. She put a tweet out which caused the pharmaceutical and biotech markets, which in 2015 were riding high, caused them to crash in a day. And then she did it again earlier this year. They crashed again.
I suppose away from like the rhetoric, what are the kind of proposals? What can they actually do about it?
So what Clinton is saying is that she's going to try and give Medicare a bit more responsibility in negotiating the prices of drugs. And at the moment, they can't do that much negotiation. So she's going to try and ensure that there's a lot more competition, which means that there's a lot more generics coming in.
She's trying to centralise the kind of buying process.
Yeah, she's trying to make the market a lot more like it is in Europe, where the buying process is more centralised, where there is more competition for the pharmaceutical companies, but less for the management. Trump thinks that they need a whole new strategy altogether. He wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which was Obama's
flagship medical reform.
Yeah, and he's saying all sorts of other things, but he wants a complete repeal of Obamacare and completely a new system of drugs pricing. And one of those things is to stop banning the import of drugs from other countries where they're cheaper. At the moment, you can't import drugs into the US.
Right.
But he wants to ban that as long as they're well regulated.
So the flip side of this, which you have rightfully included in your piece, is that politicians say one thing, especially when they're trying to get elected. And even if they try and do those things and pursue their proposals, the US president, as we've seen from Barack Obama's two terms, are constrained by by Congress.
Yeah, and actually this is quite a good it's a good point to sort of really hammer home in their campaigns, because it appeals to so many people. So many people are affected by drugs prices that a lot of people will be latching on to what they're saying. But yeah, once by the time they get in office, it's probably going to be a lot harder to actually see through on these things, especially if the president and the Senate are from opposing parties, as they have been in the Obama terms, and how the polls are looking like it's going to go at the moment. Although actually I was reading today that the polls are swinging more towards Clinton presidency and Democratic Senate, but
that's going to be key, I suppose, for these companies. They're going to be looking at not just who gets in the White House, but whether Democrats can win control of the Senate. It's going to be absolutely crucial.
Yeah, because that's a stronger base to be working off if you're all working on the same idea.
Well, thanks very much for that. And yeah, have a look at that piece, especially because it kind of talks about GSK as one of the companies that could be affected. But I'm sure we'll be reporting further on that, depending, which way it goes. So elsewhere, let's go to the results section. Harriet, you've covered Whitbread for us this week. It was a quiet week for results, but you've covered Whitbread. Normally a solid performer, not quite so much at this point. What's been going on?
Yeah, it's one of those stocks that's, again, it's a really defensive stock, and people have bought into it for long-term growth. Andy Harrison used to be at the helm, and he was an excellent manager, and the market really liked him a lot. They had a big management change when he left last year, so to say that the market's been on edge with them probably isn't unfair. The shares have had some weak moments, and Bradley Gerrard, who normally covers that stock, although he's been away this week, he did tip it on that basis, saying, this it's very odd to get weakness in the Whitbread shares, and when you do, you should really take advantage of that. So that's kind of the background to it. And then, as you say, the results came out this week, and unfortunately, the market was quite disappointed by them, mainly because the margin was down at Costa, which is one of their brands, along with Premier Inn. And traditionally, that business has just been growing absolute gangbusters. I mean, through the recession, it was one of the most successful growth brands ever seen. So when we suddenly get a margin squeeze there, I think it really sends jitters through the market. And it harks back, actually, to what we were talking about on last week's podcast about shares that are highly rated and have these good reputations. Even the slightest miss can send them tumbling.
In terms of what is hitting the margins, some of these things are shorter-term investments in the company, and other things are longer-term regulatory changes. So what are the kind of things that are affecting the margins?
Yeah, so the short-term things are things that you would be, actually, as an investor, probably quite glad to see, things like refurbishments and what have you to the existing store estate. The sort of long-term structural things that they can't control, but they just sort of have to go along with. I mean, one of the most obvious things is the introduction of new wages, which we had earlier this year.
And we actually saw some figures out from the ONS demonstrating the impact of retailers either moving early, sorry, employers moving early on the national living wage, in terms of how it's impacting on the fifth percentile of earners, and the increase that we've seen, which is like the highest increase since the minimum wage was introduced in the late 90s. So on that side of things, obviously great for lower earners, for Whitbread, who employs a lot of people in those wage brackets, it's squeezing margins, and it's not going to go away.
No, exactly. It's only going to be a problem that up until about 2020, I think, is when it's supposed to peak. So and Whitbread was one of those early movers. They started in October as opposed to April, when it was absolutely necessary. So they've been dealing with it for quite a long time, and they do say for that reason that come October this year, by the time they reach that sort of anniversary, so to speak, of when they introduce the wages, costs should sort of normalise, and year to year it won't look so dramatic. But now,
the cost base will still be larger.
It will
the
still
year
be
on
larger.
Year increasing, yeah.
But it just year to year the growth figures will sort of match up a little bit more. At the moment, it's looking like quite a dramatic squeeze.
In the past, sometimes Costa's been doing better than Premier Inn, but how is Premier Inn looking at the moment?
Premier Inn's doing pretty good, actually. A lot of it is bought-in growth, and by that, what we mean is new openings tend to drive up. But in terms of sort of regional versus London, they've still got a pretty low market share in London, so there's loads of room for them to grow centrally. And then in the regions as well, they're doing well. So it's sort of turning into a game of two halves now, which is not unlike a lot of retailers who have sort of multiple brands or multiple geographies or something like that. But it's something to keep an eye on is the Whitbread cost base.
Okay, and actually, interestingly, you also wrote the Sector Focus this week, looking at retailers, obviously, your beat, and looking at margins and how they might be impacted, and also just the top line in terms of how it might be impacted by the fall in the pound, or just generally as a result of the Brexit vote. So what are the kind of, what are your top lines in terms of the things that you found here?
Yeah, it was a piece that was sparked quite shortly after the vote, and it's sort of been gaining momentum ever since. And we've pushed it back in order to kind of take as many issues into account as possible. And of course, you know, people will remember that the minute we voted to leave the EU, the word on everyone's lips, or a lot of people's lips at least, was, are we headed for another recession? And for retailers, that's, you know, a big challenge. But we've pointed out in the piece, sadly, the GDP data was not in time. It's just come out this morning, but we, you know, it was expected to be good, and it is, you know, good for a lot of people. It's better than they expected. So recessionary fears are really receding now, but that doesn't mean that retailers don't have anything to worry about. They have plenty to worry about. The big thing is currency. Obviously, we've covered that already in quite a lot of detail, and there's sort of a summary here of which retailers are doing particularly badly on that front and which ones are kind of doing better. And then as a result of sort of the inflation report that came out last week as well, there's a lot of discussion around pricing as well, because obviously the main way that you can offset a currency imbalance is by passing it on to your customer.
Yeah, exactly right. And I suppose in some ways, inflation isn't always a bad thing for these retailers if it means higher prices. It depends on their supplier costs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as well, I think it really puts a certain end of the market into perspective. I wouldn't want to give anything about the tip section away on the podcast. It's for you to read later. But what really sort of jumped out was the premium lifestyle segment. And there are some brands in there like Ted Baker and Jules, for instance, which are sort of known as structural growth drivers, which won't mean a lot to very many people outside of the industry. But what it means is that they traditionally do well in a downturn, because customers who sort of have disposable income left and want to spend it on clothes or other sort of discretionary items, what they're looking for is quality. And so they're sort of attracted to those brands that have that longevity and that reputation.
Whereas if we contrast with food inflation, for reasons that we discussed last week on the podcast, you might not see the same kind of inflation because of the competitive pressures.
Absolutely, yeah. As with general merchandise, it can be a lot more of a sort of diverse environment in terms of competition. Everyone's got different categories. You can offset here, you can offset there. Food is food at the end of the day. And basically, it seems that everyone just wants cheaper food. That's sort of a moral issue, which has been debated at length. But yeah, you're right. The environment there is extremely competitive. And the main way to keep up with the competition is to do as many offers and cheap discounts as you possibly can. So the CPI made for some interesting reading this week. And we've got a couple of really interesting charts in there which kind of break down the categories that go into making up the CPI, and you can see how the prices have moved on the barometer. So clothing and footwear absolutely streaked ahead, whereas food retrenched again.
Thanks a lot, Harriet. And Alex, I'm just going to bring you back in, because we've had a couple of profit warnings this week. One that you wrote about in the news section, but we don't need to kind of stress too much, because it's a continuation of what's happened before, is Cobham, which continues to have kind of a tough environment, especially in its kind of satellite communication and wireless business. And so we've seen a second major profit warning, as you've said, in 6 months. But another one where we've kind of been aware that there's been some problems is Braemar Shipping Services. You have some concerns that you've raised in your piece regarding the earnings cover for the dividend. Some of these things won't come as a surprise to readers, but the tough trading in offshore continues.
Yeah, absolutely. So firstly, on the dividend, a dividend yield of 8% for a stock like this is sort of the level that investors are going to start to get concerned about. And when I put it to the management at the results this week, they said they weren't committing at this stage, or they're not in a position to commit to the final dividend. So whether that means a one-off cut to the final dividend or a resetting of the payout rate, I think that's not a decision that sounds like they've arrived at yet. I mean, they kept the interim dividend.
Well, they just didn't want to tell you.
Well, they didn't want to tell me. They've kept the interim dividend of 9p. But I mean, the cover really, really is thinning. And their end markets are, I'd say, in general bad. They don't seem to be deteriorating too much. There are a few bright sparks. For example, they're shipbroking. There's a bit more there's a bit more transactional volume picking up there. But
they think they might benefit from the failure of Hanjin.
Yeah, I mean, their chief executive said it's, you know, it's a possibility that Hanjin, this huge South Korean shipping container group, which we've talked about before, collapsed a couple of months ago, and they're basically having to sell or scrap all of their enormous vessels. So if there are any roles for Braemar in those sales or disposals, that could be a boon. Otherwise, there's quite a lot of pressure on freight rates, and I mean the work they do in the North Sea traditionally is all but dried up. I mean, their oil and, you know, their exposure to oil and gas offshore is a really tricky place to be at the moment. So,
and that's a subject that obviously we've covered, and we saw the shares in Amec Foster Wheeler fall today. So that kind of all services segment, it will come as no surprise to anyone listening to this podcast that we are still in a tough situation. But some of these assets are priced very low. So I suppose everyone's just waiting for when we might have kind of bottomed out.
I mean, I think really we have to look at, when it comes to all services companies, their geographical focus. So, I mean, Petrofac is a company we quite like. I mean, it's a high risk situation, but they're very well geared into Middle East oil and gas projects where, you know, as we've seen from OPEC's behaviour over the last 2 years, they've not really turned the taps off to the degree that the US and the North Sea and other jurisdictions have done. So there are definitely bright spots for the oil services companies. And you would expect they're very, very well geared into any recovery in the oil price. So when, you know, once projects start to get commissioned again, that, you know, it should be good for them. But I mean, the oil majors aren't getting back into this in a hurry. It's likely to come from the large state-owned oil companies more than others. So it's really a geographical play, I think, at the moment when you look at the oil services companies.
Thanks, Alex. And there's plenty more to read in issue this week. The cover story is Investment Trust Stars. So our personal finance team will be discussing that, no doubt, on their podcast. Chris Dillo is talking about inflation. We have a good piece from Emma Powell talking about the FCA's remedies for the kind of capital markets, the primary capital markets, in terms of what the FCA is trying to do to increase the competition at IPO and other capital raising operations. We should be hearing more about that in the winter, actually. There's a consultation about unconnected research and whether unconnected analysts, so not involved in an IPO or their parent banks not being involved in an IPO, can get access to company management and company information in advance of the IPO, thus to kind of provide more independent research to the market. So that's something that obviously would be meaningful for our readers if it came to pass. Apart from that, we have Simon Thompson, we've got Chris looking at the kind of buy on Halloween rule and what's it telling us about equities at the moment. And just on the subject of AT&T and Time Warner, do check out the Bear Bull column this week, where Bear Bull looks at the logic behind a mega deal, something that many people in this title are not all too supportive of in terms of how they impact the shareholders in those businesses. So do remember to subscribe, do remember to sign up to the company's email if you enjoyed this company's discussion, and we'll see you next week.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.